Incredible. Action. Astonishing. Adventure. The coolest heroes. The hottest heroines. And the most outrageous villain.
Too tough for TV.
In the universe.
These ain't your daddy's comic books, fanboy.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Heck Yeah Comics Podcast. We are back. It has been too long. We apologize for that. No, the rumors are not true. Nick is not dead. Well, not entirely dead. He is still alive inside of this podcast, aren't you, Nick?
I'm definitely dead inside. Like, I think that's been confirmed as of like 5 years ago or so.
It's that much is true. Yes. That's Nick Shermooksness. I'm David Luzader. You're the listening audience. And this is the podcast where we talk about comic books. We apologize that we were gone. Life is just life. And we kind of took some time to look at the show and think, what do we want to do with this? How do we want to go on moving forward? And we decided we're going to keep doing the show, but it's going to change format a little bit. It's not going to be general topic. Here's the news. It's going to be a little bit more, we're going to focus very specifically on sort of single topics in the show. And if there's anything, you know, big to talk about, like something we're going to talk about here in a couple minutes, we will mention it. But in general, you're going to see things being a little more focused. Isn't that right, Nick?
I don't know what it's like to be focused, but I'm willing to give it a shot. So,
Nick, you took a trip recently, right?
I spent a couple weeks out in the Southwest, traveling between Colorado, Utah, Arizona, and New Mexico. Found my calling out there. Dodged some scorpions. As you do out in the Southwest.
It's true. I can confirm.
You know, almost fell in the Grand Canyon. That was fun.
Nice.
Yeah. It's a lot nicer out there, being that I'm from Massachusetts, out there when it's like 95 or 105 or whatever, it's a dry heat. So you're walking around, it's
humidity.
It's hot, but like, it's not a big deal. The second I got back, I like stepped off the plane and it was like 85% humidity or whatever. Just like, I was like, I'm going right back. Like, I don't care. I'm just going to find a hut somewhere in the bottom of the Grand Canyon. That's where I'm going to stay.
That's the life right there. I haven't been up to a whole lot, made a lot of bread.
Yeah.
So now that we're back, one thing too about this new format we're going to kind of be trying out, it's going to allow us to bring on more guests. Like this week, we are so excited to have Phil Rood here with us. Phil, hello.
Hey guys, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. I really like the idea of you guys having your own, like, Paul is dead kind of hoax. You know, like, oh, no, it's not true. Nick's alive. Nick's alive. He didn't fall into the Grand Canyon. That's really...
Yeah. Well, usually the most shows end with David predicting my death in some shape or form. It's not completely out of the realm of possibility.
It's true. Well... Before we get started on our topic, Phil, quick, for people who don't know, you know, if people listen to me on any of my other shows, you will have heard Phil and I on Brokeback Mountain every single week talking about recently Westworld and now back to just sci-fi movies in general. But for those who don't know you from the podcasting world, just what do you do? Who are you? Huh? Who? What's your deal?
I'm just a guy. I'm just a caveman. I'm a small town girl. Living in a lonely world.
I might just be a simple, unfrozen caveman lawyer.
I'm a cartoonist and illustrator and a teaching artist. And most of my work you can see at philrood.com, or you can follow me on Instagram and see most of what I do there. I make comics, children's books, standalone illustrations, a little bit of everything.
Yeah, you guys really should. You should be following Phil because he'll also do just... On the weekends, sometimes you'll do drawings and, you know, do it live so people can just be sitting there watching you draw and you're just talking with people, hanging out there. And I've popped in a few times. It's really fun.
Yeah, live streaming's fun. It lets you not be so lonely as you're locked down, chained to your desk. You can kind of have some contact with the outside world. It's fun to have people jump in, ask questions, and just kind of... depending on what you're drawing. If you're drawing something from a TV show, it kicks that up. It's almost like podcasting in that way.
Yeah.
There's communication going on.
No, and it's always, I mean, I love seeing your art. Phil is a hard at work dude. It's not like your artist friends who like draw, who post something up like, you know, once every other month. If you guys got to follow Phil and you'll be seeing stuff like on the reg.
I try to draw every day. Draw every day. And is sort of the mantra.
Monkeys so, and
the so monkeys. What we're getting at is that Phil is the person we all wish we could be.
Exactly. That's every single day. I'm not.
Phil's the dream we've been aspiring to all these years.
Without, if you've been aspiring to all of that without money, then yeah, I am exactly what you've been aspiring to.
Well, no, I mean, that's that kind of wanted the monk life, you know, like that was.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's definitely that.
Perfect. Well,
I, you know, I'm still not convinced that Phil is not a future version of me at times. There's just, I just see that happening.
You need to make a hard left turn with your life right now.
that sounds like effort. Whew. Well, Phil, we are super happy to have you on the show and excited to talk about our subject this week. But before we get there, we do want to talk about just briefly the very sad passing of Steve Ditko. He is the co-creator of Spider-Man, Doctor Strange. He created Hawk and Dove and The Question. His art is just phenomenal, influential. I mean, man, it's the guy was 90 years old, living that recluse lifestyle. People were still writing him letters as of like 6 months ago. That was the probably the best part of Steve Ditko is I have some friends that wrote him letters, and he was always kind of a little of a cantankerous asshole to him. But that just kind of made him more endearing. Do you guys have any, you know, thoughts on Steve Ditko, on his art, any specific books that you remember of his?
I mean, Steve Ditko, other than like I've read some of, you know, like the earlier Spider-Man appearances, in large part, you know, as during my formative time of like getting into comics and being influenced by comics, you know, at the end of the day, like he's had a pretty big influence on us all, whether or not we're familiar with the person or his work. You know, if you're reading a Spider-Man comic, whether it came out in the 1960s or in the early 2000s, you've been influenced by Steve Ditko. Maybe less so by Hawk and Dove, but definitely by Spider-Man and maybe a little bit by Doctor Strange.
Oh, yeah. And if you've seen, you know, if you're not super familiar with Steve Ditko's work, but you've seen the Doctor Strange movie, you've seen Steve Ditko's work brought to life in the very literal ways.
Yeah, I think the influence of it.
Yeah.
I think his influence, I think more people, I think along the lines of what Nick was saying, more people know his work just by what he did for comics as a whole. Mm-hmm. He's one of those right up there with like Kirby and like Gene Colan and these just monsters who almost restylized the entire industry. The way comics look now is derivative of what they kind of invented at the time. So his, I feel like his influence is a lot more than just the books he worked on. It's what the impact he had on comics as a whole.
Yeah. It's the legacy that he built. And I mean, I know compared to, and I don't know how much of it, I think at the very least in later years, it was by choice. I don't know how much maybe it was enforced on him, so to speak, back in the day. But I mean, like compared to like Stan Lee, who went on to become the face of Marvel, like, you know, Steve, it was basically Steve Ditko and Jack Kirby, you know, that, you know, were part of the artistic forefathers of the modern Marvel universe back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think it's cool that people are still writing, but we're still writing him, that people were still really passionate about his work, whether or not he wanted to be in the limelight. Like, well, you know, I think we're just kind of talking in circles, but yeah, he changed the landscape of comics. I think especially with Spider-Man, his art style, I remember the little anecdote of like, I think that they had approached Jack Kirby first to do the design. I don't remember if Jack Kirby actually designed Spider-Man's costume or if it was Steve Ditko, but basically the cover that Jack Kirby did, they felt that Spider-Man was too like imposing and too muscular or too whatever. So they had Steve Ditko redesign him. And that's where like you get sort of the lanky, awkward Spider-Man of his original appearances. Cause you look at like that first Spider-Man cover, Amazing Fantasy number 15, and like the interior art, it's very different.
Yeah. Yeah, and now when I say that you could still reach out to Steve Ditko if anybody did try, you could not talk to him about comics. He would not talk to you about comics at all. There are many stories of people attempting to, even like if you met him in person, if you somehow met him in person, you could talk to him about anything in the world, and he would have a conversation with you. If you brought up Spider-Man, he would close the door on your face and send you on your way. And that just, I love it even more. Steve Ditko, you lived a long, hopefully good life. Your influence is all over everything that we love. May you rest in peace. And now we're going to be talking about not Steve Ditko work, but still, I think, great comics. This week, we have brought Phil to talk about We Three, a 2005 book written by Grant Morrison with art by Frank Quitely. It was a three-issue comic series that they described as Western manga. When a government weapons program involving animals is about to be shut down, three of the subjects, a dog, cat, and a rabbit, known as We Three, escape and try to find home while evading their captors. Phil, part of the idea of bringing you on for this was your first time ever reading We Three. What did you think?
Yes. I enjoyed it a lot. And I remember you suggesting this to me when I think I had said something. I find Grant Morrison to be complicated for complicated sake a lot of times. Really enjoys that complicated narrative, but really I don't know to what end. And I just didn't quite have an appreciation for Grant Morrison that a lot of comics fans do. And you suggested this, and I didn't get around to reading it until we scheduled this appearance, but I'm really glad that I did. I really enjoyed this. It's like a what's that Disney movie where the animals are like trying to get home, but it's so much darker.
Yeah.
it's a unique, I don't know if it's a unique concept because it's almost the same concept. It's just done with so many more layers on top of it. And it's a really straightforward narrative. It's really interesting. It's really captivating. The artwork is fantastic. And I just overall enjoyed this book. I read it twice in the last couple weeks.
Ooh, wow.
Were you familiar with any of Frank Quitely's artwork prior to this?
Yeah, I've seen Quitely's work before. And it was one of those where I ordered it from Amazon and I was like, okay, even if the story doesn't resonate, looking at Frank Quitely artwork is never a chore. Like, it's it's easy to just get lost in the visuals, and this was, I think, no exception to that.
Yeah, yeah. Sure. Nick and I were kind of texting about this a little bit, just how this is the story, and I thought you would actually like this story, because this story is very... For people who can hear that is my dog being a psychopath
in a mech suit.
Oh my goodness, Topanga, stop. You're adorable, but right now I hate you. This is a really straightforward story. It's real easy to access, to get to. But when it comes to the art, oh man. It is. This is probably, I think, some of Frank Quitely's best art that he's ever done.
Absolutely. Compared to, like, this is definitely on the same level. If not, I mean, it's been a while since I've flipped through All-Star Superman, which obviously, you know, no doubt has some phenomenal art. But this was, and I feel like I was reading some of the excerpts in the back. Like, there was a particular style that he was doing this where they were, like, really trying to capture the 3D environments on a 2D plane.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there was a certain artistic quirks that he utilized, you know, quirks is probably an understatement, but to realize the We Three world compared to maybe what he's done for like Jupiter's Legacy or any of his previous work with Grant Morrison. So there's definitely, I think, something extra to this book when it comes to Frank Quitely than maybe what we experience in any other of his works.
Yeah, yeah. There's a sequence near the beginning where you're seeing the security footage. And it's like three pages in. I can't remember. It was in the deluxe version. They talk about it, or I read it elsewhere, where that they actually drew all those panels individually on like little cards, and would rearrange them. And that's how they like developed that. Like that sequence could have gone 100 different ways. They could have arranged that in so many different ways. And just like to think about First of all, how much time must have taken to draw all of those panels? Because Frank Quitely is so detailed.
Yeah.
To, like, almost at times an obnoxious degree. And just to think of how much, because that's, I say obnoxious degree to the point of, like, Jupiter's Legacy took, like, 4 years to come out because of Frank Quitely's art. And it just to think of how long it must have taken him to do each of those individual panels and then for to, like, sit down and be like, okay, what is the most effective way to arrange these? And that sequence is so great.
Yeah, they get into it in the back of the book where he talks about they were like on post-it notes and just the amount of time spent arranging and rearranging. And I think there's a mention where they almost got thrown out at one point while they were working on it. And just a really, I can't imagine the intensity of trying to put that, because it's almost all visual. There's, I think, three or four lines of dialogue through that entire thing, and it's capturing like four different locations within the building, and just it's a brilliant piece of visual storytelling that all of that work really pays off when you take the time to pour over. I mean, it's one of those like this book's not going to suffer fools. Like, you have to pay attention to the visuals. You have to take the time and pour over those pages and look at every panel and figure out the sequence of events that's going on. It really rewards you, I think.
Oh yeah, this story also does a great job of telling, like, as you said, there's not, like, the dialogue is fairly minimalistic. You know, there's a few parts where there's people kind of explaining what's going on to get us into the world, but in general, we're just following these animals, and it's not a whole lot of dialogue from them. You know, they can talk a little bit. But like when they're fighting and stuff, there's all these little insert panels that are telling you what is specifically happening. And it can, like you said, you have to really take the time to slow down and look at each and every one, because it can get, like, you can get lost in it very
easily.
Quickly.
Yeah.
I think with a lesser artist, you know, I hate always putting people on different tiers, but like with a lesser artist for like a sequence like that, or just like the fact that the story is fairly decompressed. I mean, it's not like it's a long or super involved story, as we've said, but like if you're picking up like a $3 or $4 issue and, you know, multiple pages with minimal dialogue and just like an overall sequence of basically from A to B, it's animals escape, you know, but it's like a 4-page sequence of all these security footage. In a lesser artist's hand, you just be like, that felt like a waste of money. But with Quitely, like, because of the level of detail, the level of craft that gets put into this scene, there's definitely a sense with me rereading it, frankly, all these years later, that, you know, it's like definitely $3-4 well spent. Like, this is an art book. You're buying this for the art. You're really not buying it for the story. The story is kind of a happy accident almost in the consumption of it. But there's all these little pieces throughout the book, just little, usually just like a panel here or there. Sometimes like there's a big splash page. Like there's one, I think, like just after the opening sequence where you see the van or the truck that they're in, they're returning the base in, the pet supplies truck. There's just one large oversized panel of the interior of the truck, and you still see the truck, and it's the kind of thing you can only accomplish with comic books, or at least effectively, I'd say. Maybe you could do it in a movie, but basically the outside of the truck is all like negative and like a black space, and then you can see the interior of the truck, and that's the panel where he finds ways to incorporate the real world, so to speak, within the art itself.
No, absolutely. Like some of the more gruesome violent sequences, you know, the larger panel is the you know, the dog going through this truck, and you have these little inserts of what's going on inside of the truck. And oh boy, the violence in this book. Oof.
It is graphic. I just happened to open, I have it here, and there is a double page spread with these Apache helicopters coming down and a meadow of rabbits just getting mowed down as they're running through it. And there's a big lead up to it that is just great. It's like, run, rabbit, run, rabbit.
Yeah.
As they're pounding down out of the forest. And then you just see disembodied bunny heads and rabbit legs feet.
Flying off.
It's a really, I mean, an emotional level, it's like, it's gruesome. On an artistic level, it's gorgeous. It is just a beautiful 2-page spread.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows really that I think it does a really good job of showing you the danger that these animals are in and that they're like literally running for their lives.
And not just the danger that the animals are in, but the danger that all of the cannon fodder soldiers are in, as many of them are excruciatingly murdered in vivid detail.
Yeah.
There's like the sort of the two-page spread where it's broken with there's an attack by the dog on the top and an attack by the cat on the bottom. And mm-hmm. There's like giant panels depicting the dog like moving through the army jeep. As a bunch of little tiny inset panels show all these little zoomed in details. And the great thing that Quietly does is that he's able to capture both time and space in a single moment. So it's like one small panel, you see like a close up of the bullet. The next panel, you see that same bullet, but you're a little bit further back, but you can see that it's going right for a soldier's eye. And then by the next panel, you see that the bullet is exiting the back of the soldier's head. So even though there's pieces of the motion missing in between those three panels, you have a very clear idea of how this one bullet through the hail of bullets is making its way to and through its target.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's also some great stuff, like you said, just ways that this is a story that I don't think could be told in any other way except for comic book form. There is this really great sequence of the cat, kind of going through a group of soldiers it's so hard to explain the panel layout because they kind of become more, what's even the word I'm trying to think
there's
of?
There's a perspective to the panel as though they're spread across the room. So they're thinner when they're right in front of you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are we looking at the same spread here?
Yeah. With the cat, you know, it starts with the cat digging his claws into the soldier's head. Yeah.
And you're almost watching the cat come out of one panel and enter another. So you're literally watching him move through time and space.
And it's an amazing sequence to watch. And you couldn't see this in any other format. I mean, this is what comic books are all about at their best, I think.
Right.
Yeah, and it's not to say that it's not like they couldn't make a Wii 3 movie. In effect, I think like way back in the day they had talked about
it.
But like it's obviously there, we could totally watch a film of you know, RoboCat, you know, slicing through a bunch of shoulders, all the shoulders exclusively.
That's the PG version. It's just the shoulders.
Don't worry, they're fine. Yeah. It's just a scratch on their shoulder.
We don't need shoulders anyway. Through the soldiers, and it could be visceral, it could be bloody, it could even be well executed. But just as we've described, like the way that this panel is cutting through time and space is something where like it's kind of like when they tried to comic bookify the first Hulk movie. Obviously Eric Bana is the best Hulk there. But you know, there are the times where like the guy would get caught in the explosion and then like it would freeze into a panel and then move on to another scene. Like that, those situations like that were just it's a novelty effect, but it's not as effective in a movie as it plays out here. Like if they try to accomplish this in a movie, I'm sure there's some very talented director that might be able to find a way to make it work, but it still wouldn't be the same.
Yeah, and that's a question I had. Gave your thoughts on it there, Nick. But Phil, do you think this could be a movie? First of all, could the content get cleared to be a movie? Because I don't.
It'd be like Watership Down. You know, the really brutally violent bunny cartoon of the 1970s that
all the parents took their kids to. It's like, yeah, it's bunnies.
Generation of children and. This could be a movie, but I don't think it would be as effective. I think it would be a straightforward, it would be an R-rated Homeward Bound. It would be just this. I think what you're rewarded with in the comic is what we're talking about, is the way they use visuals, is the way they use panel layout. And the fact that in a comic you control the pace as the reader, and you can take as much time poring over Frank Quitely's artwork as you want to and control the pace of the story as they're going through. I mean, look at these panels that we're talking about with the cat mowing through the soldiers. They show that in a movie, even in slow motion, it's over in 30 seconds. Here you get to really appreciate.
You get to stop and look at each panel.
They're showing you.
Yeah.
That opening sequence that ends with a perspective shot of all the bullets flying through. That's, that's going to be the freeze frame that Nick was talking about. That the gimmicky shot that goes, look, we read the comic, guys. That's why we're making the movie. And I just, it's one of those stories I think is uniquely suited for a comic book as opposed to any other medium that you could put it in.
I definitely agree, because when I first read this, I had to stop after the second issue because I cried about the bunny. Like, I was so emotionally devastated. And not like the bunny itself is very sad, but it's the dog sitting there calling himself Bad Dog. Because of what happened.
I was wondering about that, David, because I know you don't react well to animals getting hurt in movies and things like that.
And I forgot how hard this book, and I've read it a few times, but it's usually a couple years in between each reading. And I just reading this like today, again for this, I was like, oh, I forgot. Oh, no. He's, like even that big dog, that number four that comes in at the end, it didn't ask to be there, you know? It didn't ask to be in the mech suit.
It's the Frankenstein's monster. They all are. They don't want to be these perversions of science and these war machines. But
And if it didn't have a happy, if it didn't have like at least the ending of the cat and the dog get a new life with that homeless guy, I would have never read this book again.
You would have just thrown it in the trash and been like, I'm done with you, Grant Morrison.
Yeah, just Ron Swanson with his computer in Parks and Rec just taking it to the dumpster.
Now, in terms of the... Because I think in one of the opening pages or one of the excerpts or something like that, they talk about how this is a morality tale or a cautionary tale. Obviously, the story is basically, let's not put animals in mech suits, bare minimum. But I mean, we do have certain scenes where it's like, and I'm actually going to tie this into Westworld for a second. It's a little bit different. And obviously, the discussion can maybe go a bit farther than the boundaries of this podcast. But I was talking to a friend about Westworld once, and she was saying that like she can see what the show is doing, and maybe she's a sociopath, I don't know. But she was saying that at the end of the day, like, the robots didn't have, no matter how sentient they might seem, the robots didn't have true sentience because we still created them, which obviously is a big tenet in the show. But the idea of, like, any of the robots that were being killed, at the end of the day, they were just robots. They weren't actual humans.
First of all, how dare this friend?
It's a controversial opinion. And it's hard because obviously I watch Westworld and I'm just like, oh god, no, I can't believe they killed that person.
Oh, Teddy, no.
But so I kind of attribute to this where, I mean, I would argue, like, if I was talking with my vegetarian girlfriend, she would be like, you know, don't kill the animals. But obviously in this situation, you know, when it comes to, I guess, like, moral relativity, you know, where there's a sense of us rooting for the animals, because I don't think no one wants the animals to die, but they were strapped to giant death machines, and at least a dozen, if not more, people are dead as a result. Not just like soldiers that were conscripted into this fight, but also like the dad and the son survives, but like the dad shows up and is just trying to protect his son and also dies. And it's like, I mean, we're watching something that we can't control unfold in our eyes, and there's that certain level of just like, I can't initially blame the general in the beginning for being like, you know, because he makes a point to say in the beginning, like, these animals were basically picked off the street.
Right.
You know, they were domesticated animals that were put in these situations. We didn't breed them for this specific thing. Like, there's so many things that can go wrong.
But then he's saying we should breed some for this program and not just pick them up off the street.
Right. In theory, in an ideal situation, if you're breeding the animals, you probably have a bit more control over their behavior.
How about we don't do that?
I mean, obviously, at the end of the day, don't make animal killing mech suit or animal mech suits. But within the context of the story, there was a certain level of like, I wanted the animals to survive, but I couldn't blame the military for also trying to shut them down.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Absolutely. Like, absolutely, shut that shit down. I mean, look at how wrong it went in the story.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's you don't blame the military for wanting to shut them down, but you can blame them for creating these killing machines in the first place.
And it's one of those.
I think that's where the morality tale comes in, is saying, hey, maybe don't mess with this stuff.
Well, right. But is it like a level of, okay, they created it and they shouldn't have, but do they deserve to die as a result? Is, you know, the animals might not necessarily deserve to die either, but in the grand scheme of things, you know, a bunch of soldiers basically said, yeah, I'll go into this battle because I'm a soldier and I follow orders and that's what I do. And by the way, you're not going home.
Yeah. There's also a level of the story of like, look at what war and machines of war do to us.
Sure.
Like they are things of death. I think that, you know, this is a morality tale in the sense of like doing these kind of things to animals is a really bad idea. And like, it's really horrible because animals don't have this choice that maybe like a soldier does. But at the same time, like, yeah, these soldiers made a choice and now they're dying for other people's mistakes. And there's a lot that could be said about that on a larger scale.
No, absolutely. How do you feel about Roseanne, the woman that let them go? Like, I know they kind of make a point in the story to kind of say she's a little odd, a little off.
I think she's one of those people that just like identifies more with animals. You know, she likes animals better than people.
David, would you have let them go?
I would have never let that happen in the first place.
I would not have worked at that laboratory. Yeah. But.
I was on Indeed. I was looking at jobs, and they said we need one animal murder machine technician. And I thought, I'll Burger King's hiring. Well, see, I think I'll take my.
The problem with that, though, is that you need 5 years of animal murder machine experience. And like,
right. you just out of college, you
right?
Know?
You can't get that unless you have the job. It's, you know, it's a real catch 22.
Back in the day, maybe, but not
right. You know,
today.
you would have started like sweeping up their droppings in the murder.
You got your DeVry student loans to pay back, and yeah. You just take the job that's offered to you.
This was really
She was an interesting character. There's a really subtle thing in the background of that where, like, she has apparently just lost her father. She's kind of feeling alone in the world, and I think that is part of what drives her decision to set these animals free. You know, she's very attached to her bird.
Yeah, that poor bird too.
Yeah, that bird left alone in the apartment. In the opening panels of her in the apartment, there are sympathy cards around her, and there's a hospital bed in her home office.
Yeah, that goes to like some of the great work this book does of not having too much dialogue where it doesn't need it.
Yeah. It doesn't club you over the head with it.
What'd you say, Nick?
I didn't like that. First, does it explicitly say that her father passed? Because now that I'm looking closer, I see the sympathy cards and
I don't know the hospital bed. I don't know that they say it's her father, but there is a picture of her with an older gentleman in that office. I assume it's her father. As she's walking out of
at the door, yeah, there's a picture
the office
of her
looking for her keys. There's her in a graduation cap and gown.
Oh, gotcha. Okay, I totally see.
It's an assumption, but I think it's just a very subtle character building thing that they put in there, and I think that's the brilliance of all of this. Whether that was Morrison or Quitely or a combination of the two, they don't club you over the head with anything. They just let the story play out and the details do the work.
Well, no, you're in terms of her acting as like a fully, you know, multidimensional character, you're 100%. I mean, I've read this book maybe at least 3 times in my life, including like earlier today. And I didn't even pick up on those details. Like that to me, I was just describing like, she seemed kind of off. But now there's like an even deeper reasoning to her do it. And like, as you're saying, the great thing about it was that we weren't hit over the head with it. Like it's the details are there for you to take away, and you can decide how much does this infer into her character, or you don't.
Yeah.
Right.
And that goes back to, this is not a book that you're like, oh, well, I'll just like read it real quick. I'll, you know, cause it's only 3 issues. It's like less than 100 pages. It seems like it can go real quick, but if you go through it real quick, like you're going to miss the little details of that. You're just going to see her walking around her apartment looking for her keys and, you know, not catch like the picture of her dad, the sympathy cards, her, like her eyes starting to, you know, fill with tears as she's looking over the situation, and that informs, you know, all this time she spent with these animals that she feels very attached to are now also about to die, and so she lets them go. And you can kind of even see like the hesitation of her before she does it in the 3-page, you know, security camera thing. Like she's standing at that computer for a little while, like, am I sure I'm gonna do this? Is this the right thing to do? And then she unleashes them and all hell breaks loose, as the story goes.
It weighs on her. You can just tell the way she walks through those halls with that. She's looking down. She's got those heavy shoulders. It's just the body language is just another... just the artwork. I just can't get over just the acting and the visuals of this book are just astounding.
Yeah, yeah. I really can't... I just can't talk up enough how good this book is visually. And, you know, as hard as it is for me to read, it's such a treat to do so. I think now, as we're just kind of winding down in our discussion, do you guys have anything else, any other thoughts or questions that came across your mind while reading this book?
Other than just going over some of the pages again, just the beyond just like his ability to capture time and space within a single moment, so to speak, his ability to capture speed and movement, movement specifically, like the scene, like I feel like I'm reading it and I don't always have like a visceral experience. Like when I'm reading a book, it's like I'm absorbing the content, but I'm not experiencing it. And what this book allows you to capture, even when sometimes it gets into elements that you can only accomplish in a comic book. But like the scene where the dog basically kind of leaps right in front of one of the army jeeps, like that sense of motion, the speed lines, you know, the weight, like you can feel the weight of these different characters from the mech suit and the dog to the other humans, to the environment. Like, even though, like, frankly, I mean, there's some rooms, frankly, like sometimes like his details are very sparse. Like they're just in a very plain room. Like a lot of times Quietly actually isn't that detailed with his environments unless he really needs to.
Yeah.
But it doesn't always feel like it's just talking heads in a, you know, a void. It's always done purposefully. Even if it maybe when he's like really tired in the middle of the night trying to get this book out before a deadline, he's just like, we're not gonna put anything in this room. Like there's still a sense of purpose to the details that get included. So yeah, just overall like that, the sense of motion and weight that the book carries.
No, absolutely.
It's amazing.
Frank Quitely's real good at getting your eye right where he wants it to go. Phil, do you have anything else about this book you wanna
I want to just point out the it's kind of the last action scene when they're in that warehouse and the soldiers are closing in on the dog and the cat are the two left, and the only way for them to fit out of the hole, out of the vent to get out of the warehouse, they have to shed the suit, and the dog
grabs the cat. Yeah,
the cat, and the cat does not want to leave that suit. The cat is sort of enjoying being a killing machine almost. Even though it's a suicide mission, what? It wants to go on like a kamikaze run.
And I also felt the cat was a little bit afraid of like, oh no, the dog's gone from being a friend to being a dog again.
Yeah. Is he attacking? But also, I mean, there's also that aspect that like once he pulls the cat out and you see the electrodes plugged into it, you see where it's hairless in some spots. And this is just a mangy, literally naked cat, and that plays into it too. Like it's afraid to be without the armor. It's afraid to be unprotected. Mm-hmm. And I just, that's to me, that's almost, I don't know if I would call it a touching scene, but it's a really impactful scene.
Well, even just beyond the actions, like the dog is constantly repeating, like, is coat, not we. Like they're basically saying that the suits aren't us, that there's more to us going on than just these mech suits.
Yeah.
The dog is trying to convey, you know, these complex feelings through the whole thing, you know, like the bad dog, good dog, you know, good, mm-hmm. good
help,
number
help
two.
Man, good man, good man, you know, yeah.
And it's all these complex feelings, but the dog's brain cannot keep up with it. And it is a little bit heartbreaking at times. So it's the way they build characters out of simple-minded killing machines into likable characters that you're really pulling for. It's moments like these. I think it's great storytelling.
One thing that I thought was interesting is the scientist, because I'm going back towards the end, and the scientist that walks up to the homeless man and the animals, like he's the one that testified,
yeah,
and like calls out the senator for the program, right? Even though like he's probably also complicit in the program, but like he looks, I don't know if it's just because his hair's done up for the Senate hearing or whatever, but like he looks different. Even like two pages later, you see him in his trench coat with the senator or the general or whatever. But like, he's the guy earlier in this, in the comic where like, he's the one demonstrating like the mice with like the drills and stuff.
God, yeah.
And like, there's a certain sadistic pleasure that he gets out of it. So to me, he didn't strike me as the kind of guy that would rat out his superiors, you know, in sort of like a moralistic way. But that's kind of the vibe that I get. So I couldn't tell. And I was trying to flip back. I felt like there was two scientists that had goatees and glasses, but I'm thinking I might be wrong.
Yeah, no, I'm trying to, because you don't see the face of the guy who does the sadistic killing. You don't see the faces of the people watching the rats.
Well, I think it's the same guys, though. Like, it's I mean, the guy, because the guy that's demonstrating it, like you can see in one panel, like his face is cut off, but you can see the bottom of his goatee. And also, like, they do a zoom in of his mouth when he's doing the demonstration, and he's also clearly has a goatee. So now I'm thinking that there is just one guy with a goatee, and I guess he has a change of heart as the story goes on.
Yeah.
He's cut a deal.
Or he's cut a deal, that too. Probably
that they're all going down. But he does take a stack of Benjamins out and gives to the homeless guy to take care of those animals.
So. Yeah, I feel like there's got to be a sense that he recognizes that those are the animals.
Oh, yeah, I think he gave them to him. I guess the homeless guy runs up on him. But yeah, I think he definitely realizes, oh, well, like, that's them. No need to get them in further trouble. Here's some money. Get them fed. Good job. I get so emotionally invested in this book, and I hate/love the help wanted posters at the beginnings of each chapter for the different animals, because it adds the layer of how horrible this all is and makes you feel more attached to all the bad things that are happening to them. It's just a great, and they're obviously made by like kids, so it's a great little detail that I also hate them for.
Yeah, they're not strays off the streets.
Yeah.
These are children's pets.
These are families' pets, yeah.
From families, yeah.
Well, I think it is safe to say that we all love this book. At least, from the visual standpoint, Frank Quitely is a master of his art. And Grant Morrison, of course, working with him, those two can produce some real great work. Phil, thank you so much for being on the show with us.
Oh, thank you for having me, and thank you for pushing me to read this book. This is one of those things that you read it and you go, how come more people aren't talking about this book? Like, it's one of those I think really overlooked and underappreciated gems of comics that I don't read a ton of superhero stuff anymore, but this is what I love about comics, is when a story like this comes out.
Yeah. And
my question is, why hasn't Hollywood made an abomination of a film yet based off of this concept?
Probably because not enough people recognize the brand.
Yeah. It would have to be animated, right? It would have to be.
Well, I think in an ideal world it'd be animated, but animation rarely ever gets the budget that it needs for, if you want like a great spectacle, the chances of them getting a halfway decent live action budget is probably more realistic, which is weird because I feel like, wouldn't animation technically be cheaper than,
yeah,
you pay a bunch of cheap animators in South Korea to do most of the work instead of hiring $1 million actors?
They do, you know, it's Vertigo, so it's a WB property. So, I mean, they do plenty of animated stuff with, you know, their DC works. I don't think it's out of the question for them to do something. They did All-Star
Superman.
There's
like Superman. The DC Universe animated works, and then there's What We Three Deserves.
Right. No, I agree with you. Speaking, though, of films, next week you guys can join Nick and I as we're going to be talking about both the graphic novel and the movie. This is another thing we're going to be doing. Haven't thought of a good name for it yet, but we're going to look at works, you know, as they are in comic book form and in movie form. We will be talking about I Kill Giants, which is a graphic novel that is from Image Comics, and the movie you can either rent or find streaming if you have Hulu. So, you know, if you have Hulu, go watch the movie, and if you have the chance, read the comic and join us for our discussion next week. Phil, where can people find you around the internet?
You can find me at philrue.com, or you can find me on the Brokebot Mountain podcast with David Luzader.
Hey.
Look how that turned out.
Yeah. Hey, Nick, where can people find you on the internet?
I usually tell them, like, in a ditch somewhere, probably being eviscerated by animal murder machines.
Well, there you heard it. You can find me around the internet under the username Davluz. That is D-A-V-L-U-Z. So Twitter, Snapchat, Instagram, you can find me there. And you can find me on the Brokebot Mountain podcast and Movie Go Round. You can find the show at heckyeahcomics.com or on Twitter at heckyeahcomics. And you can always join us here next week. Same heck yeah time, same heck yeah channel. Until then... goodbye.
The worst episode ever.